each one of them having their own setup, and their own followers, of course, their own factional pals in their various fields that they control. Now, Cannon tells us that by 1926, he was pretty well fed up. He couldn't dope out what's going on. The two groups were at each other's throats all the time. No differences, politically speaking, but the factions were kept alive through gossip, through suspicions of what the other side was going to do, what they really meant when they voted for the resolution, mutual suspicions and so forth. And this created an intolerable situation inside the party. Well, in 1928, Cannon, the Sixth Congress of the Communist International was taking place. Naturally, all these congresses took place in Moscow because it was the only country that would allow such a gathering. And Cannon went to this Congress. Cannon didn't want to go, he says, because he didn't see much sense in going there. But his faction demanded that he go because we have to have our representative there when Foster and Lovestone have theirs. So when he was there, he was put on a commission to study the program that was being submitted by the Russian party for adoption as the program of the Communist International. Up to this time, the Communist International did not have what we call a finished program. They operated on resolutions, specific resolutions on specific events. But now Bukharin, working with Stalin, had drawn up this program for the Communist International, and it was based on the theory of socialism in one country, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. Now let us see why the Communist International ceased to be a help to the various national parties to solve all these problems that came popping up down the road as they were trying to build the organizations throughout the world. In the early days, when Lenin was alive and Trotsky had great authority inside the Communist International, as I pointed out, that when they went to Moscow with these problems like the American party did, on the question of being underground or coming up in an open, legalized party, when they were buffaloed by the question of the Labor Party, they went to Moscow and they got an answer and they got help to solve these problems. After that, nothing. Instead of helping the problems, the logs were thrown on the fire, and it resulted in greater factionalism inside the party. And on top of that, at two different conventions of the Communist Party in this country, the majority, led by Cannon and by Foster, were ordered to submit the leadership to a minority, led by Ruthenberg and Lovestone. Ruthenberg died in 1928. All these were puzzles, of course, as I said. They couldn't understand it. Well, they went to this convention in Moscow, the Communist International, in 1928, and Cannon was put on this commission to study the program that was going to be submitted to the Congress. And somehow or other, he says, through some kind of a big mistake, alongside of the information that they were given to study the program, the copy of the program itself and so forth, came a criticism by Trotsky of this program. And after this document became known as the criticism of the draft program of the Comintern, the Communist International, in which Trotsky analyzed what it meant when Stalin and his cohorts were talking about building socialism in one country. To make it very brief, Trotsky said, socialism in one country means exactly that. Socialism in one country and no other country. If you start saying, I can build socialism in Russia, the next breath you say, if the capitalists don't butt in. If we have peace for the next 75 years or a couple of centuries, we can build socialism. All right, you come to that stage, you've taken the first step. The second step is, we don't want any foreign intervention. And what we must do now is order the communist parties in the respective countries where their rulers, the capitalists, are friendly with us, we must order them to play dead. No more class struggle in those countries, because they'll only aggravate our friends. Our friends, like in the United States. During the 30s, our friends were the capitalists in this country because Roosevelt recognized the Soviet Union. Had Congress recognized the Soviet Union. Up to 1934, the United States government didn't recognize the Soviet Union. Well, they did, and overnight, John D. Rockefeller, Morgan, Mellon, the big steel and oil and so forth, all these people became pals of the Soviet Union. If you can reason it out, you're a real magician. But that was the nonsense that was peddled. That's what it led to. Take step A, you take step B. Take C, B, you have to take C. And the result was that in those countries where that played ball, as the communists thought at that time, those countries that had an alliance with the Soviet Union, the parties had to lay dead. In France, the French capitalists signed a pact with the Soviet Union, 1934 or 1935, called the Stalin-Laval Pact. And immediately, the French communists were ordered to support the French capitalist government, which they did, right up to the outbreak of war. In the United States, the American Stalinists supported the American capitalists 100%. Now, this development didn't take place overnight. Stalin first threw out this theory of socialism in one country in 1924, and it was debated inside the Russian party. But the big monkey wrench in the machine was this, that the Stalinists by this time had already developed a bureaucracy inside the Russian party that controlled the whole state apparatus, which meant the newspapers and everything else in the Soviet Union. Now we want to know, well, how come? How come? In other words, the socialism brought this tyranny. Not at all. We, being Marxists, we look for the material conditions. The Russian people had been at war from 1914 to 1922. First in the Tsarist War, the First World War, then the Russian Revolution, followed by the war with Poland, and then in 1922, the terrible famine in which millions and millions of Russians died, including Trotsky's father and some leading members of the Bolshevik Party. Why I say that is to show you that in those days, the leadership of the Bolsheviks didn't live off the fat of the land. That came only with Stalinism. Now with this terrible exhaustion that took control of the Russian people after the end of the war, the Civil War, the war with Poland and famine and so forth and so on, with this exhaustion came a change inside the Soviet Union. Lenin and Trotsky and the whole leadership of the Bolsheviks had counted on the European Revolution coming to their aid. Lenin 1,000 times said that we can never last unless the European Revolution breaks out, meaning mainly the German Revolution. While the German Revolution was crushed by the German capitalists, the army and so forth, and didn't come to the aid of the Russian Revolution, and a spirit of defeat, defeatism you might say, entered into the lifeblood of the Russian people. The party itself, which was a small party, the Russian Bolshevik Party that led the revolution, was a small party. Probably not more than 75,000 that had any concept of what Marxism was in the true sense of the word. The party had grown overnight, was flooded with a lot of heroic men and women in the early days of the revolution, when in order to join the party, you had to go into the front lines and lead in the fighting of the Civil War, not stay behind and direct the fighting over a telephone. None of that stuff. And the result was that the ranks of the party became decimated. The leadership became decimated through assassination, through hunger, through dying from malnutrition, and a million and one other causes. Lenin himself was there was an attempt on his life in 1918 or 1919. Well, by 1924, the old gray mare wasn't what she used to be, and the old Bolshevik Party wasn't the old Bolshevik Party anymore. With the victory of the revolution and the consolidation of power came another great enrollment, a rush for membership inside the Bolshevik Party. And these boys that joined then were not the same type of self-sacrificing revolutionary workers that joined in 1917, 1918, and 1919. In 1924, we had what we call a Leninist enrollment. This was under the leadership of Stalinism, where they were going to take in 500 or 600,000 new members to strengthened the party with the death of Lenin. And it was in this enrollment that a whole flood of old Mensheviks, men that had opposed the revolution, came into the Bolshevik party. The man that prosecuted the Bolsheviks at the Moscow trials came in this gang. A whole gang of Mensheviks led by the man that afterwards became Stalin's theoretician on the Chinese Revolution, 1925, 26, and 27. What's his name, Lenin? Who? Martynov, yeah. He became the great theoretician of Stalin. This was the man that Lenin polemicized against in What Is to Be Done. An outspoken counter-revolutionary Menshevik. Troyanovsky, he became the ambassador to the United States in the 30s. Maisky, the ambassador to Britain at the same time, and the ambassador to France at the same in the 30s. The three of them were Mensheviks that opposed the Russian Revolution and were all picked up by Stalin and utilized in his fight against the revolutionary wing of the party. To make a long story short, they triumphed. Stalinism triumphed. They defeated the left wing, led by the left opposition, led by Trotsky, and then turned on the right wing, led by Bukharin. In other words, they were centrists. One of the features of a centrist is that he has no program. So he says to the left, you're a little bit right. He says to the right, you're a little bit right. And I'm in the middle. And he plays one group against the other. And that's what Stalin did. He played ball with the right wing in order to crush the greatest threat to his power, which was the Bolshevik wing of the party led by Trotsky. And he put forward side by side the theory of socialism in one country, which was right up the alley of the great masses of Russian people. Now, they control the apparatus of the party, the newspapers and so forth and so on. As I explained last week, they'd conduct a campaign proving that Trotsky was wrong. They mobilized all these ex-Mensheviks, as well as old Bolsheviks, that wrote article after article, day after day, radio announcements and so forth and so on, attacking Trotskyism in a distorted form, of course. And after they had sold the bill of goods, we see it done every day in the United States, as the German philosopher of pessimism, Oswald Spengler, said in one of his wise cracks, and there's a lot of truth in it, after 3 weeks, by the three weeks of campaigning by the press, and the truth is established. Hey, that's not bad. What did they do in the United States? 1940, they picked up the lawyer of J.P. Morgan Company, the public utilities lawyer of J.P. Morgan and Company, a man named Wendell Willkie, that not one in 100,000 Americans ever heard of. And in 6 months, they got 24 million sheep to go down and vote for this man, for president. Don't tell me it can't be done. Well, if that could be done, you can imagine what happened in the Soviet Union, where everything was controlled by the Stalinist apparatus. They proved conclusively that Trotsky was wrong. And after they had proven, they said, okay, Trotsky, now your turn to answer it. That's how they operated. On the public platform, the left opposition speakers were booed and howled down. In many cases, physical force used against them. It was this method that Stalinism got control of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. Now, all of this was not known throughout the Communist International. They were fed all kinds of propaganda from Moscow. There were individuals sent to Moscow and educated to come back and spread the truth. In the United States, they did the same. Hathaway, a man sent from this country, was one of them. He became the editor of the Daily Worker. And naturally, he was a very efficient Trotsky beta. The party in the various countries were misinformed, had no idea what was really going on inside the Soviet Union, knew nothing about Trotsky's position, because there was such an overwhelming weight of evidence against Trotsky and the left opposition that it was hard to cut through all the rubbish and the mountain of lies that was pumped out by the Stalinists. And that was the condition under which Cannon went to Moscow in 1928. He said that in the political committee in this country, and at the plenums of the National Committee of the Communist Party, inevitably there would be resolutions introduced by the right wing of the American Communist Party, Lovestone and gang, and by Foster, leader of the trade union gang, because they knew it was fashionable and one way to keep in good with Moscow. There were resolutions introduced by these gangs denouncing Trotskyism. And as Cannon told me one day, he said, liar works for Hoover Library now. Wolf. Bertrand Wolf. He said, Bertrand Wolf, all was needed was a little pinch. And Bertrand Wolf could get up and give a lecture for 2 hours on the Russian peasants and how the left opposition was sabotaging. No matter what was going on, they were sabotaging. Cannon says he never gave a talk against Trotskyism inside the Communist Party. Why? Not because he was any better than the others, but because he didn't know what the hell was going on and he wasn't going to say anything. That was the only basis on which he kept quiet. He afterward confided to Vincent Dunn and to Carl Skoglund in Minneapolis that after when Trotsky had been expelled and they asked him what did he think of it, he gave him the answer that, who am I to criticize the leaders of the Russian Revolution? He didn't say Trotsky was right or wrong, because he didn't even know he couldn't trust Vincent Dunn, and he couldn't trust Carl Skoglund. That was the, inside the party, there was such a terror created. Inside the American Communist Party, there was such a terror created against anyone that supported Trotskyism that you had to keep quiet, or anyone that had any suspicions of Trotskyism. Finally, when Trotsky was expelled, and he was expelled only shortly before the Sixth Congress, in every branch of the Communist Party in this country, the question was put point blank to the membership to vote on the expulsion of Trotsky. That was when Anthony Kornikow, the founder of this party here in Boston, was kicked out. She wasn't kicked out of the Communist Party because she defended Trotsky. All she said was, how can I vote to expel Trotsky? I haven't read his side of the story. Kick her off. She's a Trotskyite. That's how she was kicked out of the party. She was given 3 days to go to New York and explain the situation to Lovestone, who was the secretary of the party. Now, about factionalism. Factionalism is outlawed by all reformist leaderships, no matter where you go. No matter what party you go to in the Second International, you will find that factionalism is outlawed. Of course, they discovered that only that's in the Third International. But they themselves, you open, let a left-winger open his voice in the Second International, and he'll soon be looking on the outside. Factionalism is outlawed by all reformist leaderships. You'll find that in the American Federation of Labor, CIO, right here in the United States. These are the people that criticize the Russian Bolsheviks. There's no democracy inside the Russian party now. Now, factionalism is not caused by bad people. It isn't caused by bad people at all. It isn't caused by soreheads, as the impression is given by all kinds of petty bourgeois wiseacres. Not at all. We might say that factionalism is part and parcel of all political organizations, regardless of what kind they are, whether it's Tammany Hall. Don't they have factionalism in Tammany Hall? Don't they have factionalism in the Boston Democratic Party, whatever you want to call it, Republican Party? They're all struggling to get ahead. That's the basis of their factionalism. But in a revolutionary political party, factionalism is based on a different interpretation of different events. It's part and parcel of every live political party. There wasn't any factionalism, you might just go out of business. It means that everybody's in agreement and there's something screwy with this kind of an organization. All great events and maneuvers require answers. A revolution happened in China, 1949. We have to take an answer. We have to give an answer to this. Is it a working class revolution or is it a capitalist class revolution? British socialists have taken power in Britain. They just voted. They got a majority, so they must have socialism tomorrow morning. Well, if you're an idiot, you believe that. But your party has to take a stand on this and has to know what is what. Now, any political party is made up of human beings. Don't forget that. And they spring from all the different sections of society, and they interpret events and happenings in different ways, from different viewpoints, from class viewpoints. And they draw different conclusions from the same events that everybody else has seen. And in order to fight for the position that one takes, it's only natural that they unite. There's no other way they can fight for their position or their concept of what kind of a state China is, or whether they are going to have socialism in England now, or whether we have socialism in Boston because the state took over the MBTA. That would be socialism for Norman Thomas, but not for us. And when you have these individuals taking different positions, you have an alignment inside the party that is called factional. It's a factional alignment. Now, no one else has ever been able to solve political differences inside a party outside of a factional alignment except Comrade Stalin. And we don't want any Stalin. We can think out our own problems and fight to our own conclusions. Lenin himself said that a party through internal struggle purges itself and strengthens itself. And that was what took place inside the Russian party. It either purged itself and strengthened itself, or it purged itself and weakened itself. And that's precisely what took place in the Russian Communist Party. It purged itself of its Bolshevik wing, its revolutionary wing, and we see where it ended up today. Now, what does factionalism mean, though? Factionalism means that it's a party within a party. The logical conclusion of factionalism is, when it's drawn to its final conclusion, if it's allowed to develop and harden into two hard and fast positions, it relegates itself to being a party inside a party. That's the negative side of factionalism. And from the experiences that we've had in our American party, we might say that that with the development of factionalism comes a development of distrust and suspicions and so forth of both factions. And rationalism is often thrown out the window because of a warped sizing up of the situation. Subjectivism rules among many factionalists and many factions. That was what was one of the main dominating factors in the Shachman gang here in the United States. And no question about it, it was one of the main factors in the Stalin faction in the Soviet Union. Mainly from the right wing of the Stalinist faction, which was made up of these renegade socialists that rallied to the revolution in 1924. In other words, they rallied to the victorious revolution and the entrenched revolution. Only a strong leadership can keep a faction on its balance, on its a real political balance, so that it doesn't go overboard and go into business for itself. And above everything else, factionalism has to be based on principled politics, or else it degenerates into a personal struggle like developed inside the Russian party, where the centrists, led by Stalin, were not interested in politics at all. They're interested in entrenching themselves in the party and getting control of the party apparatus. And inevitably, such a factional lineup in general leads to a split in the movement. Now, that's what happened in the Russian party. As I said, the membership of the parties outside of the Soviet Union were ignorant of what was developing inside the Russian Communist Party. And the easiest road to success was to denounce Trotsky. Now, when Cannon was on this commission to study what was going on, what was the program of the party, and he got a copy of Trotsky's criticism of the program, of the proposed program, he said a whole new world was opened up to him. The veil of the mystery of Trotskyism was removed. The mist that he couldn't see through of why the decisions were made in Moscow to increase the fury of the factional struggle in the American Party was all cleared away, and he saw what really was Trotskyism. And he decided that the best way he could serve the movement was to make sure that he brought a copy of this program, this criticism, out of the Soviet Union to the United States and launch a struggle to have it accepted inside the communist movement. Now, Trotsky analyzed it and said what I said before, that it meant giving up the international class struggle and rallying the good capitalists to the support of the Soviet Union and reducing the communist parties throughout the world to nothing but frontier guardsmen for the Soviet Union. Not to make a revolution in their country, because they might upset the apple cart and start a war again, but rather to come to peace with their national capitalists and be frontier guardsmen protecting the Soviet Union while they built socialism in the Soviet Union. Well, alongside of the expulsion of Cannon was expelled when he came back to this country. And he tried to circulate this document among his closest friends, and hardly had he started when he was expelled in September of 1928. Now, he was expelled, but he didn't walk away from the Communist Party. When the party had a plenum in November, Cannon, Shachtman, and Ahern, the three leaders that were expelled, went to this plenum and demanded the right to be heard, according to the Constitution of the American Communist Party. And they were heard. They were given a hearing, a couple of hours. Chuck Cannon spoke for a couple of hours, and of course they knew that it was futile, but they went there with the hopes of being able to educate some of the members, some of the other leaders of the party, and so forth. In other words, they didn't quit the party, they were expelled. They wanted to get a hearing from the most advanced section of the American working class. And where else would it be but in the Communist Party? Nowhere else. The party convention of February 1929 was also an occasion for the distribution of literature by the Trotskyists. Now, the Trotskyists weren't expelled all over the country in one great mass. They were expelled individually, here and there. Three or four in Boston, that's all. And there were several others that afterwards were expelled. 15 or 20 in Chicago, a few here and there, so that after about 9 months, they had a convention totaling up to 100 members in 12 cities, scattered throughout the country in 12 different cities. Now, at the Communist Party convention, they distributed the program of what afterwards became the program of the Communist League of America. And this was the first Marxist program adopted in the United States. It flowed from the international question to the national question. Previous to that, all political programs in this country had been written from the national side of the question, then the international was dragged in by the hair later on. But not this time. For the first time, the international question was put first, that is, the Soviet Union, and the revolution flowed from the Soviet Union's position. And during this period, they didn't turn their back on the Communist Party. From now until the seizure of power by Hitler, the American Trotskyist movement oriented itself towards the Communist Party through agitation, through propaganda, through the newspaper and so forth and so on, because the Communist workers represented the most advanced political workers in this country. If a worker became a radical, if an intellectual became a radical, he went down and he joined the Communist Party. He didn't join the Socialist Party, he joined the Communist Party. And naturally, if you wanted to get any kind of recruits for your party, you had to go where the radical workers were. Now, the Militant started out as a four-page monthly paper, tabloid size. Don't think that we are always as strong as we are today, Collins.